continue where we left off before, and with this sutta called Ignorance from the Anguttara Nikaya Tensa, number 61. And we have just seen the whole sequence, how ignorance or delusion, how avidya is rooted in not seeing the Noble Ones. And then we come to this summary paragraph, and a nice simile after that. And of course the reverse sequence afterwards. As we're used to in Buddhism, you always have the forward sequence and the reverse sequence again. So repetitive, but slightly different. So it's still quite interesting to have a look at the reverse sequence as well. So this is what the Buddha has to say. Thus, not associating with the superior persons, becoming full, this fills up not hearing the good Dhamma, the Sadhamma. Not hearing the good Dhamma becoming full fills up lack of faith. Lack of faith becoming full fills up careless attention or unwise attention. Unwise attention becoming full fills up lack of mindfulness and lack of clear comprehension. Lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension becoming full fills up non-restraint of the sense faculties. Non-restraint of the sense faculties becoming full fills up the three kinds of misconduct. The three kinds of misconduct becoming full fill up the five hindrances. And the five hindrances becoming full, they fill up delusion or ignorance. Thus there is nutriment for delusion and ignorance. And in this way it becomes full. So this is how you fill up delusion. That sounds pretty bad, doesn't it? Delusion becoming full doesn't sound very good, so it's a bit of a turn off. So here we have, but then we have the nice simile to explain this, how this works. And again, the simile is also works for the reverse sequence as well. Just as when it is raining and the rain pours down in thick droplets on the mountaintop, the water flows down along the slopes and fills the clefts, the gullies, and the creeks. These becoming full fill up the pools. These becoming full fill up the lakes. These becoming full fill up the streams. These becoming full fill up the rivers. And these becoming full fill up the great ocean. In the same way, there is a nutriment, and thus there is a nutriment for the great ocean. In this way, it becomes full. So just by keeping that rain, keeping raining on that mountaintop, gradually as it kind of keeps on raining, it seems like it's only a small little thing, a little bit of water coming on the mountaintop, right? But if you keep on doing it, and keep on being persistent, committing yourself to these teachings, committing yourself to listening to the real Dhamma, seeing the noble people, etc. If you keep on doing that, let the rain coming, eventually that rain will fill up the great ocean itself. It seems so insignificant what you're doing. It seems so small, right? But almost by magic, it keeps on filling up the larger and larger bodies of water until the main body of water, the ocean itself, fills up as a consequence. Shows you very nicely how it is the case that the very basic things, if you do the basic things right, then eventually you have to get there. That's what it's basically saying here. So too, not associating with a good person, etc., fills up not hearing the good Dhamma, and eventually that fills up the ignorance or delusion, the avidya. Thus there is a nutriment for delusion. In this way it becomes full. So here we have the negative side, but exactly the same thing, of course, is also true for the positive side. So let's have a look at the positive side, because that is always the most inspiring thing. And of course, it is a little bit different, so it is worthwhile having a look at this regardless. I say, because that true knowledge and liberation have a nutriment. They are not without nutriment. And what is the nutriment of true knowledge and liberation? It should be said, the seven factors of awakening. So this is the beginning here, so true knowledge and liberation. This is awakening itself. true knowledge here is vidya, the opposite of what we have been looking at so far. This is what I've been calling insight. And the three main insights, the three main vidyas that we have on the Buddhist path is precisely the knowledge or the recollection of past lives, the insight into the laws of karma, and then the becoming an arahant at the end of the path, where you destroy all the defilements, all the corruptions of the mind, and you know that rebirth has come to an end. That is what those things are at the very end of the path. This is what the true knowledge is about. And of course, it includes insight into the Four Noble Truths, into the three characteristics of existence, dependent origination. All of that is part of that. So you get this really broad, full insight into what existence really is about. That's what it comes down to. What is existence about? What are we as human beings? What does it mean, really truly mean, to be human? And this is what the insight you get. Prior to this, we don't really know. We are still deluded about ourselves. We don't see ourselves as we really are. And suddenly one day, whoa, this is what I am. Jeepers, that's pretty not so good. I thought it was better than this. There's a few delusions I had about reality. And especially the idea of self, non-self. That is a critical thing on this path of Buddhism. And then there's the other side of the coin, that you are liberated, right? There's the freedom, of course, is a very important part of this. What are we liberated from? And of course, the main aspect of liberation is liberation from suffering. That is the most important part. That you are free of suffering, no more problems, no more end of all the nuisance and all the things that always make life so miserable. Sometimes happy, sometimes miserable. And this is the problem. You're liberated from all that. What a wonderful thing that is. At the same time, you're liberated from all the defilements of the mind, all these things that are always pulling you by the nose, driving you around like a slave, being a slave to craving, as it says in the suttas. All of that you are free from. And you feel free. You feel like now you are, in a sense, able to take charge of your own life, do whatever you like. And what is that thing that you like to do? Just chill out, sit down, cross your legs, close your eyes, watch your breath. That's pretty much what you want to do at this stage. Everything else is kind of become irrelevant. So that is true knowledge and liberation at the very end of the path. And these very beautiful terms, the full understanding of a reality. And it's obvious that if you want to be happy, you have to see things in the right way. You have to have real knowledge of things. How can you make the right decisions in your life if you are blinded, if you can't see what is right and wrong? It's like, you know, going down to the shops and you are going to buy yourself a meal, a dinner or whatever, but you don't know where the shop is. You think the shop is to the left, the shop is actually to the right. And you go to the left. What happens? You never get that meal. You go hungry. Why? You suffer because you had wrong knowledge, wrong understanding. Everything in life, all happiness depends upon having the correct knowledge and vision of things. Wrong knowledge always leads to suffering because we make the wrong decisions about what we should do and how we should live. So it's crucial to see things in the right way. So we investigate and we hear the Buddha says there is no real self, and like, oh, that's very interesting. Let's check it out. Let's see if it actually is true. And then you follow that trail. You kind of like, you follow the, it has a feeling of being right to it because the Buddha is very persuasive in the way he presents his teachings. You follow that and eventually you find out for yourself whether it's true or not. If it's not true, okay, well, at least you have been living well and doing the right thing. But of course, what you do find that these things are pretty much spot on. The Buddha has understood these things correctly. So what is it? What is the cause then? What is the nutriment for all these wonderful things that await us at the end of the path? And as always, this is one of those things that, again, you see throughout the suttas. I mentioned it yesterday already. The cause for all of this is the seven factors of awakening. And these seven factors of awakening are essentially about samadhi. Yeah, I said yesterday that the seven factors of awakening that slot in on the Noble Eightfold Path, where you have right mindfulness and right samadhi. So this is all about samadhi practice. Very similar to the sutta we looked at yesterday about the what I call the psychology of meditation, how you it leads through all the stages of piti, rapture, tranquility, sukha, and eventually samadhi. Yeah, very similar to that that part. So this is what takes you to awakening. Samadhi is the cause for seeing things in accordance with the reality, as we saw yesterday. Here it takes you all the way to true knowledge and liberation. These seven factors of awakening, just in brief, what they are, I think we have time to touch on that now. So the first one is the Sati Sambojanga. Sambojanga means factor of awakening. Sati means mindfulness. So it starts off with mindfulness. So that is very similar to Satipatthana practice. Satipatthana is a mindfulness practice, using mindfulness in the right way so as to move towards samadhi. That is why Sati Sambojanga is actually at the very beginning of the Sambojangas, because Satipatthana is the practice that leads to samadhi. Yeah, often this may sound counterintuitive, that Satipatthana leads to samadhi, because very often the idea is Satipatthana leads to insight, and it is a practice in its own right. But everywhere in the sutta, it is very clear that Satipatthana practice, the purpose of that is actually to lead you to samadhi, to lead you to the unification of mind. And you will see that in the next step here. It is very clear. The next step actually says, well, what is the nutriment for the seven factors of awakening? And actually it does have the establishments of mindfulness there, which are the Satipatthanas. Yeah, and that's so that Satipatthana is the nutriment for the seven factors of awakening. And the first factor of the seven factors is precisely Sati, Satipatthana itself. So you can see how this kind of fits together very nicely here. And so you practice Satipatthana. Another way of practicing this is to recollect the teachings, to actually reflect on the Dhamma itself. That is another way of doing the Sati Sambojanga. These are just alternative ways. But the main principle is Satipatthana practice. What is Satipatthana practice? It's watching the breath, right? Sitting down, watching the breath. While doing that, you're actually doing the whole Satipatthana. It is really as simple as that. Then from the Sati Sambojanga, you have the Dhamma Vichaya Sambojanga. Dhamma Vichaya means like something like investigation of Dhammas. Dhammas here means like means something like principles, like causal principles. Yeah, or it can also mean mental states or mental qualities. So you investigate mental qualities, but specifically you understand the causality of these things, how they arise, how they stay, so that you become adept at actually producing these states of samadhi through your practice. So the Dhamma Vichaya Sambojanga is all about understanding what is truly wholesome, what is unwholesome. What is kusala? What is akusala? What is anavajja? What is savajja? What is blameworthy? What is unblameworthy? What is dark and what is bright on this path? And this may perhaps seem obvious. You know, we know that certain things are blameworthy, certain things are bad. It may seem obvious, but of course, there is great subtlety to these things. Fully understanding what is blameworthy as a mental phenomena, you know, the subtleties of desire, the subtleties of ill will, the subtleties of restlessness, the subtleties of tiredness and lethargy and these kind of things. These things have very subtle aspects to them, and fully understanding this is what this is about. Because we are here dealing with Satipatthana, this is equivalent roughly to the last stage of Satipatthana. Satipatthana is body contemplation, feeling contemplation, citta, mind contemplation, and Dhamma contemplation. Dhamma contemplation is what this is about, understanding the good and the bad qualities. So you can see it is almost a perfect overlap with Satipatthana practice. So this is the very end of Satipatthana. This is where meditation starts to become very deep. And it is just before we are ready to enter real samadhi, the jhanas, and these kind of things. So we're already a long, long way on the path, right? You're already very happy in your meditation, sitting there, but you realize you can't fully make the breakthrough to real samadhi. Why is that? It is because there are certain defilements in the mind that are hindering you from making that last leap and then, attain full unification of mind, the full bliss of the jhana states and this kind of thing. So you investigate, you wonder what's going on, what's stopping me, and you see these little defilements that are there. And this is how you separate, you do the dhamma vicaya, investigational qualities, understanding where the problems are. There is a nice sutta about this in the Majjhima Nikaya called the Upakilesa Sutta, the sutta on the small or the refined defilements of the mind, the corruptions of the mind. And here is one of those beautiful Buddha autobiographies where the Buddha talks about his own life and his own practice. And he says what happened to him, right, while he was practicing. And what he says there is that he was investigating all these mental qualities that were blocking him from attaining full samadhi. And there's a long list there of mental qualities. I can't remember how many, 10 or 12 or something like that. All kind of little subtle things like fear and these kind of things that the Buddha talks about blocking him on the very last path into samadhi practice. Very nice list, very interesting. If you are very far on the Buddhist meditation path, that is when this becomes very interesting, because you can see the subtle problems that stop you from going all the way. But it's also very interesting because it makes the Buddha come alive as a real teacher, as a real person. He struggled on the path. He had his problems. He just didn't sit down and attain jhanas just like that. He went through, obviously, a lot of practice, a lot of difficulties before actually getting there. Yeah, it's kind of nice, right? We feel, oh, it's so hard, can't get there. The Buddha had problems too, right? So you are in really, really good company if you are struggling and getting there. You are in company of the Buddha himself. Isn't that kind of nice? So the Buddha had these problems. What do you expect? Of course, it's not going to be plain sailing into the jhanas, right? Oh, how come I can't get the jhanas? Well, relax, take it easy. You will get there eventually. Learn from what the Buddha has to say. And then, whoa, you will also be able to do these things. This is what is so nice about this. It makes the Buddha become human. It makes the Buddha somebody you can relate to. He's not this kind of, whoa, the Buddha, don't know what to think about the Buddha, he's just way out there. He's not. Before the Buddha's awakening, he too was human, just like the rest of us. And I will show you this more as we come to the next sutta, or this couple of suttas down the line, and it was more about this coming up later on. So that is the second Sambuddhanga, the Dhamma Vicaya, investigating the qualities of the mind, understanding how they arise, how they don't arise. Oh, I'm seeing the teddy bears are starting to get used now. I suddenly see the teddy bears now. That's very nice. They are there for a reason. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 teddy bears already out. Okay, 6, 7, okay, 8. Okay, that's very good. 9, okay. Good, that's great. So soft teddy bears are always very helpful. So that's Dhamma Vicaya, right? Investigational Dhammas, having the teddy bear next to you, kind of contemplating the Dhammas. I should have a teddy bear. How come I don't have a teddy bear? Is there any spare teddy bears? Pass you one. I have a co-teacher. The teddy bear can be the co-teacher here. I have to lead by example, right? If I don't have a teddy bear, I'm a bad example. Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. Okay. Oh, look, he looks pretty cool, doesn't he? Looks pretty. So, okay. Great. Okay. Sit there and meditate. Okay. So that is the Dhamma Vicaya Sambuddhanga, and when we then investigate those dhammas and we fully understand what these things are about, and then we, by seeing what the problems are and seeing what the good qualities are, by doing that we're able to abandon the bad qualities and move on to the good ones. You have to understand these things, how they are caused, how they are supported to be able to abandon them, right? It's pretty obvious when you think about it. And then, as you abandon them, you get the virya sambuddhanga, the energy arises. because you are free from these things that de-energize you, the defilements of things that sap you from energy. And once these things are let go of, the mind becomes incredibly energetic as a consequence. And you will notice that in your own meditation practice here or at home or wherever you do it, that when the mind is pure, it tends to be has much more energy. The more defiled it is, the more kind of bad stuff is going on, in the long run at least, it drains the energy from the mind. So that is the energy, and with that energy comes the mindfulness, right? The mindfulness, when you have energetic mind, you become very awake, very clear, you know what's going on. And with that energy also comes a sense of gladness usually. Energy, gladness, pamuja, virya, sati, these are factors of the mind that tend to work together. And then they are the ones that make meditation possible, really. So now energy arises. From that energy, or conjoined with that energy, comes then the piti, piti sambodhanga. Piti is the joy, right, or the rapture. Different words can be used. This is where the happiness becomes even more pronounced. You start to feel very powerful, strong happiness physically, etc. Then you keep on going. Now all you're doing now, remember, is just watching the breath, right? That's all all you're doing. And you're allowing this process to happen by itself. You're not doing these things, you're just watching it happen. And because you know how it's supposed to happen, you know that you are on the right track. So the piti sambodhanga, from that comes the pasaddi sambodhanga, the factor of awakening of tranquility. Everything becomes incredibly peaceful, like we were talking about yesterday. Exactly the same sequence we were talking about yesterday. And then from that tranquility, from the happiness that comes with the tranquility, comes the samadhi sambodhanga, the unification of the mind, where the mind merges in with the object, and that's where the real samadhi, the jhanas, and all of these kind of things happen. And then, when you take the samadhi far enough, eventually you get to the upeka sambodhanga. And the upeka sambodhanga is the equanimity, the evenness of mind, factor of awakening. And that happens when you take the samadhi to the level of third and especially the fourth jhanas. This is where these things happen. So the idea with the upeka sambodhanga is that the mind is incredibly powerful at this stage. You have already let go of the hindrances a long, long time ago. But then you go beyond just giving up the hindrances. You keep on developing the mind beyond that. It's like a continuum, right? You have less and less and less hindrances until the hindrances are completely gone, and you feel really good about that. But then you keep on building up that positivity to become even stronger. And the deeper you go in the meditation, the more powerful your mind is. Yeah, and this is what happens here. Upeka sambodhanga is where the mind is incredibly powerful. You go beyond all happiness and pain, and you have this incredible equanimity. And because you have equanimity, the other meaning of the word upeka is just to look on. You're just looking on. You're able to see things undisturbed. The mind is unperturbed, no longer being driven this way or that way because of the power of the mind. Regardless of what happens, you just observe. You just see what is going on. And that is why at this stage the mind has that ability to break through even to the most profound aspects of the Buddhist path. Seeing things that normally would scare you, but now you have the ability to kind of keep going. Non-self. It is scary. Initially, why is it scary? Because we are so used to this delusion, used to seeing everything in terms of me and I. And if that very me is challenged, it is frightening, right? Because it's like your identity is being challenged. Actually, it's nothing to be afraid of at all, because it's just a happy, very, very blissful realization when you see these things. But in the meantime, it's kind of scary because your sense of identity is being challenged. That is why you need a strong samadhi to see these things. You need a very powerful mind. So you are really even, you're really cool. You're just watching, unperturbed. You call this the imperturbability at these states of mind. Because you're imperturbable, nothing can move you anymore. You can just stay with whatever you want to stay with. Okay, so that is the seven factors of awakening. They're really a really nice and really inspiring factors on the path, but very profound, of course. Once you come to these things, the Dhamma becomes so beautiful, so much bliss. You don't really know what to do anymore when you come to this stage. There's nothing else you want to do except practicing these things and continuing on that path. So what is the nutriment for the seven factors of awakening? And as I just said before, this is the four establishments of mindfulness, or if you like, the four applications of mindfulness. So Satipatthana, where does it take you? It takes you to Samadhi. This is the main purpose of Satipatthana practice, to take you to Samadhi. This is what it's all about. It's about abandoning defilements, understanding the problems of the mind. Is it about insight or is it about calm? It's about both of those. You gain insight into the problems of the mind. And when you gain insight into those, you're able to abandon them. Insight and calm, two sides of the same coin, always go together. Why? Because the things that block insight are exactly the same things that block calm. When you remove the hindrances, right, the hindrances are a problem both for, actually I shouldn't say insight, because I said the other day that was a bad translation for vipassana, and now I'm contradicting myself, but let's just call it vipassana and samatha. Samatha and vipassana are both caused by a lack of defilements in the mind. So remove the defilements, remove the hindrances, both samatha and vipassana must happen as a consequence. This is why they always have to go together, because they have the same cause, the same condition that actually makes these things possible. Yeah, you can see, it's not hard to see why, because calm is obviously disturbed by defilements. If you have desire and ill will, you're not going to feel very peaceful, but it's also going to distort your outlook, so you can't see clearly. So these things must go together in a sense. So this is Satipatthana in brief, and remember that when we talk about Satipatthana practice, all you really have to know about that is that if you watch the breath, you are fulfilling the Satipatthana. You don't have to do anything apart from watching the breath. That's enough. And Mick keeps it very simple and very straightforward. And then contemplate your meditation a little bit at each end, so that you can see, you can understand how the progress happens. Yeah, you get some feeling for what perceptions you should develop, what things you need to let go of, how to use your mind in meditation. That is what you find out at the end every time you meditate, ideally, or whenever, you know, when you are in a retreat or whatever it is. So those are the Satipatthanas, and if you look at this list we are looking at now, and you compare it at the negative listing we were looking at this morning, you will see the Satipatthanas are in the same place as the five hindrances was this morning. The five hindrances come after the three kinds of bad conduct. The Satipatthanas here come after the three kinds of good conduct. So they are in the same position on the path, the reverse kind of position. So that shows you again what the Satipatthanas are about, and what they are about is overcoming these hindrances, getting rid of these hindrances. That is the purpose of these things. So that is the four Satipatthanas, the four applications of mindfulness, the four focuses of mindfulness, if you like. And so what is the cause? What is the nutriment for the four applications of mindfulness? And it says here that the three kinds of good conduct. Yeah, so it kind of rings a bell, doesn't it? The three kinds of good conduct we're talking about before. Body, speech and mind. What is it that makes meditation possible? What is it that gives rise to mindfulness? These were the things I was talking about before. And I was saying all you need is sila. And here you are, sila again, conduct, character, our temperament, all of these kind of things. That is what supports Satipatthana, mindfulness of breathing, meditation practice in general. That's where it comes from. This is the thing that makes these things possible. So the more you have of the three kinds of good conduct, the better off you are to start off your meditation practice. Once that three kinds of good conduct really come together, meditation tends to be very, very easy. You just sit back and it just happens by itself. Nothing really you have to do whatsoever. So three kinds of good conduct. Remember, this includes the mental good conduct, of course, and that is why this actually is quite profound in many ways, and why it takes a lot of practice to get this right. The three kinds of good conduct too, I say, have a nutriment. They are not without nutriment. And what is the nutriment for the three kinds of good conduct? It should be said, restraint of the sense faculties. Yeah, so again, I was talking about that this morning. The idea of using wisdom to know when you are going wrong and to direct your mind in the right way. And I'm going to talk much more about this later on, how to actually do this in practice. But it's the idea of thinking in the right way so as to avoid the mind getting thrown around by desires and aversions and ill will and all of these kind of things. It is the wisdom faculty that we use in this case. And what is the nutriment for the sense restraint? It should be said, mindfulness and clear comprehension. So again, you have to have enough mindfulness to know what is going on in your mind. And when you know what is going on in your mind, then you can take different courses of actions. Take a different direction, go somewhere else, because you are aware of what is happening. You catch yourself out in time. You know, you can head in the right direction. And the clear comprehension knows whether you are fulfilling the purpose of what you want to do. Are you heading where you want to do? Is what you're doing now suitable to get you where you want? Where do you want to go? You want to increase in good qualities, decline in bad qualities. Is that what's happening? Okay, good. Then you're heading in the right direction. Full awareness, clear comprehension, sampajanya, purpose and suitability is what that is all about. Then, mindfulness and clear comprehension too, I say, have a nutriment. They are not without nutriment. And what is the nutriment of these things? It is careful attention, wise attention. Yoniso manasikara. Attending to things in the right way. Knowing what is useful. Knowing what is useless again. Seeing whether the mind is heading in the right direction, whether it is not, and then attending to those things in such a way that you get a decline again in the bad qualities and improvement in the good qualities. Yoniso manasikara is like when you look at another person and you see, maybe you get very upset with somebody and you see, okay, this is what's happening now. What do I need to do to avoid this upset? That is yoniso manasikara, and you know what you have to do, and then you do that, yoniso manasikara. Or you are you're going to eat a little bit too much. You know it's going to be bad for your meditation afterwards. So yoniso manasikara says, okay, stop. Now is the time to stop. This is just right for me. Okay, you stop here. Sometimes when you come on a 9-day retreat, right, you're used to having a dinner in the evening and you think, oh, I have to make sure I eat enough at lunch. And then you eat a little bit extra and then you really regret that afterwards because it was just too much, right? After a while, when you've been a monk for 20 years, it kind of becomes second nature. But it's much more difficult for you guys because for you, you are not used to this. So I know how hard it is sometimes. You're really kind of a bit fearful about these matters. But please don't be fearful. Remember, usually it works out very nicely. After a while, you get used to this idea of not eating in the afternoon. So it usually works out quite well. So that is yoniso manasikara, finding that right balance in things, knowing what is appropriate, what is not. And a very important term in the Buddhist teaching again, this idea, this ability to reflect wisely. And of course, what is interesting here is that the nutriment for yoniso manasikara is faith. And this is one of those peculiar Buddhist things that faith is the cause for wisdom. Yoniso manasikara being wise attention. What is the cause for wisdom? Faith is the cause for wisdom. It's a very nice and very, I think, very interesting and meaningful thing, this idea that confidence and faith actually are just the almost like the reverse side of the coin from wisdom. These things always go together. So you start off gaining that confidence in the word of the Buddha. Why do you get that confidence? Well, because you have a little bit of yoniso manasikara already. So there's a little bit of wisdom there. That little bit of wisdom gives rise to faith. That faith gives rise to more wisdom. So they can see how these things kind of interchanging, building on each other all the way towards awakening itself. So the faith in the Buddhist teaching, the confidence that these things are right, and this is one of those things that I have always found so useful about reading the suttas and reading them again and again and again, contemplating them over a long period of time, to seeing what is actually there. After a while, that confidence becomes very strong. And this is one of the things I like about teaching the Dhamma, because I feel that having studied these teachings so much, you feel as if there is so much to share about these things. I know how difficult it can sometimes be to access these things and to get the full benefit of these teachings when you're starting out. I know many of you have been, are not exactly starting out, but even if you've been doing this for quite a few years, still there are new layers of depth to these teachings. Every time you hear them, they sink in a little bit more deeply. You've heard it before, but then one day, wow, now I understand what this means, right? And it takes time with these things. And it's one of those great things is to be able to share those little insights that you have obtained over 20 years of actually studying these teachings. That is the faith and confidence factor that grows as you keep on studying these things. And of course, the studying of these teachings is precisely the hearing of that good Dhamma, yeah, which is then the cause for that faith. As you see that it is very has a lot of integrity, these teachings. They're very coherent. They hold together really well, and they match incredibly well with one's personal experience. And then you start to feel that these things are really worthwhile following. And then again, as I said before, it is, of course, the association with good persons that is so crucial on this path, because that is where you get to hear those teachings, the true Dhamma. So this is the cause, that is the rain on the mountain. The rain on the mountain is associating with the good persons. And of course, one person that you should associate with, who is that one person? The Buddha, yeah. So it sounds, people think, you can't associate with the Buddha, for goodness sake. He's just this literary character, right? It's character of fiction in the suttas. But you are. Every time you read the suttas, you are associating with the Buddha, right? Because here he is. Here he is teaching us. He knew that we would be coming together 2,500 years after his time. He knew that the wheel of the Dhamma would keep on turning for a long time. So he did think about us. So he is our teacher. So when you read these things, you are actually associating with the Buddha. And that's pretty cool, isn't it, to associate with the Buddha? I find that really, really nice. It's a very nice idea. And I'll talk a bit more about that later on. So this is where it all starts out. So let that keep on raining. Keep on associating with these people. Keep on reading the suttas, listening to those good Dhamma talks, to the good explanations of what these suttas are all about. And as you keep that rain coming, don't forget the rain, right? Keep on raining. If the sun comes out, you know you're heading in the wrong direction. So let the rain coming, keep on coming, and then you will be okay. Because it is so easy to be distracted in ordinary life. I know that all of you live very, very busy lives. And you all have your jobs, you have your families, you have your all kind of things. And when you live in the city, even if you don't have a job and family, still there's all these noises and things happening around you all the time, regardless of what happens. And this is the magic of coming to a place like Jhana Grove. When you sit down here in the early morning and in the evening especially, it's almost magical. It's the peace and the moon coming out, the stars in the sky, and the kind of the little sounds of nature that you hear outside. It's very, very magical and very beautiful. And get into that sense of beauty. You know, use that while you're here to the maximum benefit. Enjoy that. Indulge in that, right? This is one of the right kinds of indulgence. The indulgence that lead to ultimate non-indulgence. We have to indulge in the right thing. When you indulge in the right thing, then it leads to the end of indulgence down the path. Like you have to crave a little bit, to crave for the right thing leads to the end of craving. Desire a little bit of the right thing leads to the end of the desire. If you didn't have any craving at all, you would never even come here to Jhana Grove. You'd be sitting at home, vegging in front of the TV or something like that instead. I'm sure you wouldn't do that. I'm just joking. I'm sure that you are, you know, wouldn't do that too often anyway. I'm sure that's the case. But you know the idea, what I'm talking about. And so it's so easy to be sidetracked in the world. And because of that, that is why it is so important to allow this continuous reminder of what really matters in the world. What is important? Sometimes you come to Jhana Grove or you read a Sutta of the Buddha and you know that this is true. But before you have kind of left the center almost, you already have forgotten about it. And you go back to ordinary life and you've forgotten about all of these things. So you need to renew it again and again and again. And as you do that, the commitment, the perseverance to the practice start to become stronger and stronger and stronger, gradually, stage by stage. And that is when this really starts to work out, and it works over a long period of time as a consequence. So that is the what this... It's interesting in a sense, because it sounds quite easy, right? All you have to do is listen to good Dhamma talks, and then everything else happens as a matter of course. And of course, what it does, it just inspires you, and that's what's the whole point. It inspires you to do what is right. And then you actually do that as a consequence. But what this is really saying, it is sufficient to actually listen to those Dhamma talks, and everything then tends to happen from that. So let us look at the simile again, just to fill out the very last bits here. Thus, associating with good persons, becoming full, fills up hearing the good Dhamma, the Sadhamma. Hearing the Sadhamma, becoming full, fills up the faith, the saddha. The saddha becoming full fills up the careful attention. The careful attention becoming full fills up the mindfulness and the sampajanya. Mindfulness and clear comprehension becoming full fill up the restraint of the sense faculties. The restraint of the sense faculties becoming full fills up the three kinds of good conduct. The three kinds of good conduct becoming full fill up the four focuses, or the four applications of mindfulness. The four applications of mindfulness becoming full fill up the seven factors of awakening. The seven factors of awakening becoming full fill up true knowledge and liberation. Thus there is nutriment for true knowledge and liberation, and in this way they become full. Just as when it is raining and the rain pours down in thick droplets on a mountaintop, the water flows down along the slopes and fills the clefts, the gullies and the creeks. These becoming full fill up the pools. These becoming full fill up the lakes. These becoming full fill up the streams. And these becoming full fill up the rivers. And these becoming full fill up the great ocean itself. Thus there is nutriment for the great ocean, and in this way it becomes full. So too, associating with good persons, etc., becoming full, fill up hearing the good Dhamma, which fills up the seven factors of awakening, which fill up the true knowledge and liberation. Thus there is nutriment for true knowledge and liberation. In this way they become full. And... there you are. So keep that rain coming. One of the problems in life is that we often feel autonomous. We feel that we are in charge of our lives. We feel that, yeah, I'm going to go out and practice the Dhamma on my own. I know what I need to do. It is not a problem at all. And we forget that the sense of self, that sense of being autonomous, of being free, having a free will, of feeling that we can always choose the right thing. But that is part of the process of delusion. The sense that I am in charge, I know what I'm doing, I know where I'm heading. Part of that is part of the delusion of the self. And that is why, this is one of the reasons we have to be very careful with this excessive, sometimes, autonomy, this excessive idea that we can go strike it out on our own and do things in our own way, and we will still get to the goal. Often we hear about people who are practicing a spiritual path, and they say, oh, I don't want to have any kind of spiritual path, you know, it's all just institutionalized religion, organized religion. I don't have anything to do with organized religion. I'm just going to go my own way and do my own thing and find out for myself. And the problem with that kind of approach is that it overestimates our ability to be independent. It overestimates our ability to see things in the right way and do things appropriately. And this is a major problem. But just like in every other sphere of life, if you want to be a doctor, you don't just put up a sign somewhere and say, Dr. So-and-so, without going to university first. First of all, you study. If you just put up a sign and say, well, I'm going to be a doctor now, you're not going to get many customers, right? They're going to say, well, I better watch out for that one. He's really dodgy. She's really dodgy. But it's exactly the same thing in the spiritual life. You can't just kind of put up a sign and say, Ajahn Brahmayali, spiritual master. I haven't actually studied with anyone, but I just know that I'm a spiritual master, so just come to me. Right? That is really dodgy, and it's full of ego and full of all kinds of dangerous traps. And even the Buddha, and this is what is so interesting, even the Buddha-to-be before his awakening, he went to all the spiritual masters of the day. He went to Alara Kalama, he went to Uddhaka Ramaputta, and apparently he went to other teachers as well. So he did the apprenticeship because he knew that it is important to take on board all the kind of existing wisdom and knowledge that is already there and then build on that. Yeah, instead of starting out from scratch, which really is an act of silliness when there is already so much knowledge and wisdom available out there. So just like anything else, if you want to be a doctor, you study medicine at university. If you want to be an engineer, you don't start building your own bridge. First of all, you go to university. And otherwise, you go to jail if you just start building your own bridge. That's called bad karma. So in exactly the same way. So understanding our own limitations, having a degree of humility about these things, is a very important part of this path. The Buddha had that humility. If the Buddha had that humility, then surely all the rest of us should also have that same degree of humility. So come back to these teachings. Don't be afraid of being a student, right? We are all student all our lives. And it's actually a wonderful thing to be a student, a wonderful thing to learn new things, to broaden our horizons, to see things in new ways, having some of our assumptions challenged, changing our views a little bit when we have to. It's wonderful to do that. It's empowering. You feel that you're actually growing, that something is going on inside of you. And to enable us to do that in a good way, this is what we have to return to all the time. These are the suttas. The Buddha was, if we have faith in the Buddha's teachings, he was the eye of the world, right? He had seen the reality of things. And then the eye of the world passes on what he has seen to us. So we take advantage of that. We take advantage of the Buddha, in a sense, because the wisdom is already there. And we gradually make that our own wisdom as we practice this path. Okay, so that is this little sutta from the Anguttara Nikaya 61. So please keep that in mind, and then tomorrow we can then start out on the gradual training itself. And this is where we're going to have a much more detailed look at how to practice, how to overcome all the defilements, how to purify the mind, etc. In the meantime, please keep on enjoying yourself, and we'll see you again at 7:30 this evening.